Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back and we have an hour to go. It's going to go quickly. My number is 888-914-9149. Thank you for listening to the program first and foremost. I appreciate it. 888-914-9149. I have a lot of emails. Let me see if I can get a couple of them in here. This one comes in from Veronica, listening in San Francisco on our 1260 AM station. Good morning, Patrick. My daughter has a Protestant boyfriend, and she has left the Catholic Church because of him. They've been dating for 4 years. I heard her talking about marriage with my other daughter, and I got into a conversation and told her that if she was going to get married through the Protestant Church, that I wasn't going to support her and I wasn't going to the celebration because it wouldn't be valid. And she told me she wants, I can't quite understand what you're saying here. She told me she's going to invite me. I think maybe what she means is she wasn't going to invite me. I told her the only way I could be there is if she gets married in the Catholic Church, and she started laughing at me. And she told me, not even in your dreams. Ouch. I'm so sad about what she told me, and I left and started to cry. I don't know what to say, and I'm right. Am I right in telling her that I won't be going to her wedding? Thanks and God bless you. Well, what a sad and painful thing. I think I may have her name wrong, by the way. I think it was Elvia, my mistake. Thank you, Elvia. Sad, painful, and so unnecessary. You know, when a daughter or a son is disrespectful and abusive to mom and dad, it's not a good thing. And I can understand as a father how you would be wounded by that, that she would be so callous and disrespectful to you. But the fact remains, you're correct that this would not be a valid marriage because, as we've talked about countless times on the program, two atheists who get married in front of the justice of the peace, great, valid marriage. All other things being equal, assuming that they have the capacity and they're eligible to get married to each other. Two Buddhists, a Buddhist and a Muslim, a Hindu and an atheist, they can get married and it would be valid, all other things being equal. Where the problem arises is if a Catholic tries to get married and doesn't do so in the way that the church requires. It's known as the canonical form, and it includes essentially the essential ingredients that are pertinent here, is that you have to get married in a church, Catholic church that is, and you have to get married with a Catholic priest, could be a bishop, certainly, could even be a deacon. And this is the church's law. And the way the law is written, if a Catholic tries to get married in some other way, like at a Protestant church or at the golf course or at the beach or something, and doesn't seek permission from the bishop by way of a dispensation, and therefore there is no dispensation granted, and sometimes there are, but if the Catholic doesn't do that, then that is an invalid marriage, because in order for it to be valid, the church requires that Catholics be married according to the canonical form. It is what it is, and it could change in the future. But for the time being, that's what it is. So objectively speaking, I can understand the pain that you would feel, although I've not had to be in that situation myself, at least not yet anyway. But time, you know, time will tell. And human beings being what we are, I would not be surprised if at some point in the future, I myself will have to make this terrible decision. God forbid. And I hope I never do. But it's very likely that at some point I probably will. And I will take the same advice that I'm giving you here, and that is that if you go, then you're actually kind of sending mixed signals, because on the one hand, you're saying, I want to celebrate what you're doing, but on the other hand, you know that what she's doing is sinful and it's invalid as far as the marriage is concerned. So how can you celebrate that? So it's one of those decisions that parents have to make, and it's painful. And sometimes, unfortunately, it's unavoidable. So my hope is, if you can maintain some kind of a relationship with her, keep the lines of communication open if possible. And sometimes it's not possible. Sometimes maybe what you need to do in this case is to put some distance and some time between you and your daughter and let this subside for a bit. Because right now, if you're feeling really angry and really aggravated by this, that's probably not the right state of mind to be in when you're having a conversation with her about something like this. Keep praying for her. Keep letting her know that you love her. And because you love her, you'll always tell her the truth. And that you love her so much that you're not going to just simply turn your back on her making bad decisions, even though she doesn't realize that they're bad decisions now. You, as her mom, you love her. You're going to be there for her no matter what. You're not going to celebrate something that's wrong, but that doesn't mean that you love her any less or that you're abandoning her. I would continue to reinforce those messages. And I'll just put it this way. I understand how it feels when you're seeking the best for a son or daughter and they, you know, verbally smack you in the face. These things happen far more commonly than people might imagine. And I think just about any family has experienced this kind of hurt. So keep your chin up, keep praying, go forward, and be praying for her. And I will pray, too, that things resolve in a happy way. Let's go to Joseph now, McAllen, Texas. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, Patrick. My question for you today is how can I help or respond to my wife in a better way? In the fact that since the lockdown, which was, 2 years ago, she has not wanted to return to Mass. Of course, I remember, you know, of course, the first year or so, we were under dispensation here, and I didn't go to Mass, I believe, for about a year or so. But I have returned since for quite some time to Sunday Mass, and I'm very active in RCIA and Bible study and things of that sort. But her reason for not going, of course, was health reasons at first. But now, of course, she goes to stores and all kinds of other activities. But she says that the people at the church are hypocrites. And on the bigger picture, she even is doubting. She's very despondent about the corruption in, of course, of the whole church with the sex scandals. And but what's really kind of ironic is she does watch Sunday Mass. So it's like, why are you watching Sunday Mass when you could just go to Mass, which is almost right around the corner, you know? So, you know, I've asked her, you know, questions, and she just says that she doesn't want to be part of hypocrites and that the church is very corrupt.
All right, let's start there. So that's not an uncommon excuse that some people make, you know, I can't sit in a church with a bunch of hypocrites. Well, yeah, there are people who are hypocrites. A hypocrite essentially is somebody who says one thing and does another. They profess to believe or to stand for one thing, but they're doing the opposite. That's the essence of hypocrisy. And that's just another form of sin. So maybe one thing you could say is, so honey, are you saying that you don't want to be around sinners? You know, hypocrisy is one form of sin. And by the way, not everybody in that church, in fact, I would argue most of the people in that church are not hypocrites. So are you saying you don't want to be around sinners? Well,
yeah.
No, and because you could point out, well, you know, you're a sinner, I'm a sinner.
Yeah,
Jesus died to save us sinners. So if those sinners are good enough for Jesus, then how come they're not good enough for you and me? You know, if Jesus dined with sinners, tax collectors, and, you know, talk about hypocritical Pharisees, you know, he refers to them in Matthew chapter 23 as hypocrites, blind guides, brood of vipers, whitewashed tombs full of dead men's bones. I mean, he really lays into them. And one of the things he says is, you guys are hypocrites. And he would dine with them. He would go to their homes and have meals with them. And there were prostitutes and tax collectors. Now, don't get me wrong. Obviously, Jesus was not carousing. He was seeking to save sinners. So maybe if you walk her through this, honey, are you saying you don't want to be in the company of sinners? Are you perfect? Are you sinless? So maybe open up a line of communication that way. So my sense of it is, because I've heard this excuse before, this is just another way that we human beings can rationalize our own laziness or our own bad behavior by saying, well, it's okay for me to not do something that I know deep down I should do, because look at all those hypocrites over there. It's just rationalization. It's just an excuse to avoid doing something that for whatever reason she doesn't want to do anymore. But if you can pop that like a pin popping a balloon, then she won't be able to rely on that excuse anymore. Now, maybe she'll never admit it to you, but in her own mind, she realized, yeah, that's a dumb excuse. And even my husband, he sees how dumb this excuse is. I can't be bothered to be around sinners. And then maybe that will open the door for more fruitful conversations. Well, you know, honey, you know I love you and I want to be united with you as husband and wife in our love for God and putting God at the center of our marriage. And it's hard to do that if you don't have that same commitment that you once had and that I still have about being faithful and going to Mass on Sunday. How can we fix this problem? What can we do to make it easier for that to happen again? Because I want to be united with you. Maybe appeal to her at that level, at the level of the heart, yeah, and see what happens.
Yeah, that could be helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome, Joseph. And here too, I'll say a little prayer. Sometimes these conversations can yield unexpected good results. And sometimes even the simplest kind of question can open a door that seems locked. Thank you. Let's go to Katie now in Colorado. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. Hey, so I met a mom friend this summer. She's kind of more of an acquaintance. And I thought she was really great, really fun, funny. And I found out after a couple times, just seeing them at the swimming pool, that she is married to a woman. And she's, you know, her kids are the same, close to the same age as mine. And she's asked to hang out a couple of times. And I just don't know how to feel about it. I don't really feel like explaining that situation to my 5-year-old. So I just wanted to know, what do you think I should do?
Well, you can be polite and friendly and, you know, not overly friendly, I suppose, under the circumstances, but polite and respectful, but just don't let the friendship, if you want to call it that, progress beyond the point where you're comfortable, and certainly don't let it progress to the point where you now have to start explaining to your daughter things that she doesn't need to know about at 5 years of age. You know, you have far more of an obligation to your daughter than you do to this lady that you've met. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So I think your instincts are sound, that you want to protect your daughter. She's innocent. She doesn't need to know these things.
Right.
But so you can still be polite. I mean, you can still smile and be, you know, be friendly. But see, I guess what I'm asking is, I don't know what it is that she is seeking. Is she seeking to become like friends where you get together for dinner as families? Is she seeking to hang out with you? That's where you would have to decide where you're going to draw the line, it seems to me.
Right. And so I guess that's the issue that I have is, I guess I don't really know how to politely decline when she, you know, invites us to park play dates or anything like that. I don't know, because I don't want to lie to her, you know, be like, oh, my child's sick.
Just say,
or,
you know, hey,
you know, I can't.
Hey, no. I appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. That it's not feasible for us right now. We're not able to do it. Thank you anyway, though. And just leave it at that. You don't owe her an explanation.
Okay.
You're not obliged to tell her exactly what your reasons are, but you can still be polite and friendly and smile and be respectful and decline. You know, don't be afraid of it. Don't be afraid of it. My guess is that after 2 or 3 times of these invitations being declined, she'll get the hint and say, well, for whatever reason, Katie's not, you know, not interested in much more than casual interaction, and she'll move on, I think.
Okay.
Don't be afraid of it.
That's very, okay. Fair enough. I like it. Okay.
Okay. And if she gets angry and says, are you saying no because you don't want my daughter, or you don't want your daughter to know about lesbians, you could say, well, you know, as long as you brought it up, that is part of it. Because my little girl's 5 years old and she's innocent. And not only does she not need to know about your sexual lifestyle choices, but I don't want to have to explain it to her. It's age inappropriate. Now, chances are she won't ask you directly, and even if she did, you don't have to answer the question. But if you chose to do so, that would be an honest answer. All right. Thanks, Katie. Boy, we have an interesting world of questions on this program, that's for sure. Thank you. Let's go to Manuel now in Venice, California. Hello, Manuel.
Hi, Patrick. I was wondering if you could explain to me one more time. I know you did it once, but I wasn't taking that, notes that good. But I did hear you say one time that there are four types of angels. The top angel is as bright as God is, and the lower angel is like a messenger, and the second one from the bottom is an archangel. I always thought that the archangel was the top angel, but you explained that he wasn't. I can't remember the names of the other two angels above that, but I was wondering also, is Lucifer on the bottom or on the top? Because doesn't his name mean light?
Well, kind of. It means light bearer. And that's not a name that's given to us in the Bible, but that's a name that we have ascribed to Lucifer, whatever his actual name is, we don't know. But let's talk about that. So there are actually nine choirs of angels, and the very top one, that one is the seraphim, and that means the burning ones. And the reason they're called the burning ones is because they're understood to be the closest to God. Now, we're not talking about proximity in terms of distance, because we're not talking about distance. Angels are pure spirits, so they don't take up space the way we do in a physical sense. They're not in space the way we are with bodies. But suffice it to say that they're called the burning ones because they are the closest to God, the highest of all the angels. And the angels are the highest in the created order. Second to angels would be human beings. So at the very top of the nine choirs of angels, we have the seraphim, followed by the cherubim, for example. And they're called the burning ones because God himself... We see this biblical motif many times in Scripture. When God, in some fashion, appears to us, for example, he very often appears in the form of fire. So when in Exodus chapter 3, when Moses encountered God for the first time, it was in the form of a burning bush. It was blazing with fire, but not consuming the bush. So that wasn't God, but that was a manifestation of God, and fire was the motif. We see the pillar of fire also in Exodus, which was a manifestation of God's presence, and he would lead the people at times through the wilderness, sometimes with a pillar of fire, sometimes with a pillar of cloud. And at nighttime, you could see that pillar of fire be like a tornado of fire. It must have been terrifying. We see in the New Testament, we see on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, the Holy Spirit is manifested among the apostles and Our Lady and those in the upper room in the form of tongues of fire. And we just see this fire motif all throughout Scripture. So it doesn't mean that God is fire, but it means that those seraphim who are the closest to God, they themselves are on fire, so to speak, because they're so close to God. Now, the nine choirs of angels go, as you said correctly, all the way down to the lowest choir, which is angels. And it's understood that our guardian angels are from that choir. And possibly in the case of, say, bishops or popes or presidents or others, it may be that there are higher levels of angels that are given by God to guide these human beings. Archangels, we see them in the New Testament in the form of the Annunciation in Luke chapter 1, for example, the Archangel Gabriel appearing to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And so throughout the nine choirs of angels, they all have different duties. They all have different things that they are tasked with doing. And so that's, in a nutshell, what we can say about angels. There's plenty more that we could say, but I'll just leave it at that. Now, the devil or Lucifer, it's understood also that there is a kind of inverted hierarchy or a lowerarchy, if you want to call it that, and that at the highest level of the bad angels is Satan, Lucifer, the devil. And that just as in the hierarchy of good angels, there are different grades and orders, and this would involve higher to and lower powers and knowledge and capabilities, the same would be true for, at least as we understand it, for the fallen angels. And so the least of the angels who fell would be the least of the demons in that evil lowerarchy of angels. The highest of the angels who fell would be the most powerful, the most potent, even though they are disfigured and ugly and twisted and weakened compared to the good angels, their powers would be greater than those of the lowest angels who became demons. Now, I'll recommend a book because I have to take a break, but the book I'd suggest is called Angels and Devils by Joan Carol Cruz, C-R-U-Z, Angels and Devils. That book will give you a ton of information, and I certainly like talking about the holy angels. Thanks for that. I'll be right back with more right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity Healthshare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for listening. Let's go to Michael in Albuquerque. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Patrick.
Hello, Michael.
My question is, we have a foreign exchange student living with us, and she says that she's Catholic. She's gone to Mass with us, and she always takes communion. Well, she missed Mass one weekend. We had to go on a Saturday, and she was going to the homecoming dance. And so the following Sunday, she didn't go to Mass. And the next weekend, she took communion. So she obviously missed her Sunday obligation. And I know she didn't go to confession. So I've struggled like how to talk to her about this, that she shouldn't have taken communion. So I was hoping that you could give us some advice. And then I was just wondering if my wife and I need to confess that ourselves, because we kind of had a feeling she was going to do that, and we didn't really say anything. So I don't know.
Okay. Two good questions. So let's start with the second one first, if you don't mind. So if your conscience and your wife's conscience, if it's bothering you because you feel like it was a sin of omission, only God knows with certitude, but if your conscience is telling you, it's nagging at you that, well, we should have done something and we didn't, that's, you know, when we pray in the Confiteor at Mass for forgiveness for, you know, what I've done and what I've failed to do, this could fall into that second category. So I would definitely bring it up in confession. I don't think it's a mortal sin. It doesn't sound like it would be grounds for a mortal sin. But if it was a venial sin, sure. That way you know that you've gotten it clear with God. If you are not able to go to confession and you go to Mass in the venial sins are entirely absolved at Mass when you go through the penitential rite, the Lord have mercy and the Confiteor, etc. So that way you don't have to worry, like, should I not go to communion until I go to confession? Because it doesn't seem to me that this would rise to the level of a serious sin. Okay, so that's the first part. Now, as for how to handle it with her, I don't really know, obviously, because I don't know her or her personality, and I don't know what your relationship is like. Only you could make that determination. But you could say, hey, by the way, for what it's worth, and maybe you didn't know this, but the Bible teaches that you shouldn't receive communion if you are in the state of serious sin. Oh, really? Where? And then take her to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and you can begin reading the specific part is in beginning in verse 23, where St. Paul gives an explanation that Jesus revealed to him about the Last Supper and what was done, because after all, St. Paul wasn't present at the Last Supper, so he received this by direct revelation. And then he says that whoever eats or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner is guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. And he says, let a man examine himself, and so eat the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without recognizing the body eats and drinks judgment upon himself. So there's a twin warning there. The first is, we would render that into these terms: if you're in the state of mortal sin, then you're guilty of homicide. Verse 27, you're guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. Or some translations say of profaning the body and the blood of the Lord. And that would not be true, obviously, if this were not really Jesus. If it were just a symbol, if it was just a piece of bread, you couldn't really be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. So it's subtly pointing out the reality of Christ present in the Holy Eucharist. And similarly, in verse 29, if you eat and drink without recognizing the body, you eat and drink judgment or damnation unto yourself. Now, it doesn't sound as though that, per se, is part of the problem, but the first one, it sounds like, as you described it. So maybe just share that with her and just say, I'm not here to run your life or in any way to kind of tell you what you have to do because you're free, but knowledge is helpful. And in this case, just be aware that if you have a serious sin on your soul and you go to communion, then you're incurring another sin. It's the sin of sacrilege. So go to confession first and then go. Friendly advice, that's all. Now she may say, well, why would you even think to say this to me? Why would you think that I have a serious sin on my soul? That'd be my natural question if somebody brought this up to me. So you can say, oh, well, I noticed that you didn't go to Mass on Sunday, and maybe this too is something you're not familiar with, but the church's law is that we have a Sunday obligation. And if you're not able to go to Mass, that's different. If you're sick or there's some other reason you can't get to Mass, that's different. Your obligation is dispensed, so to speak. But if you can go to Mass and you don't, intentionally don't go, well, that is a serious sin. So it's just that reason, because I didn't know if you knew about that and I wanted to share it with you. And, kind of easy breezy, leave it at that and see how she reacts. I wouldn't drop the hammer, or make her feel like you're, the theology police or something like that. But I think sharing this with her maybe will help her to avoid that in the future.
Thank you.
Anyway, I don't know if... Oh, Michael's still there. Okay. Well, good. I hope that's helpful, Michael. Thank you. And I can understand why you want to be helpful in that regard. Let's go to Lori now in Carlsbad, California, that is. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Good morning, Patrick. I need your bird's eye view on my situation. I am separated for 2.5 years. I just recently got back in communication with my estranged husband, who is in a relationship with another married woman. and he won't grant me a divorce. He won't grant me a divorce. He doesn't want to let me go that way, but he doesn't want to reconcile our marriage either.
When you say a divorce, do you mean like a civil divorce? I don't think he has any choice. I'm no fan of no-fault divorce. I think it's an evil and causes a great deal of harm. But I think under the law, I'm a native Californian, but I'm not a lawyer. But my impression is that either spouse has the legal right to divorce the other for no reason whatsoever. They call that no-fault divorce. And I think that obtains in California, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think he can say yes or no.
Okay, because that's what he's believing and telling me, that he's not going to sign the papers ever.
I mean, he can say yes.
He's not going to grant me a divorce.
Well, he can't. He doesn't. Okay, you're going to have to check with a lawyer on this. And I'm not a lawyer, so all I can tell you is my impression is that he doesn't have a choice. If you divorce him and you serve him with the papers, there may be some provision in the law that stipulates that you need his signature, but then again, maybe not. I just don't know the law, the divorce law, and so that's where if you talk to a divorce lawyer.
Well, in lieu of that, on a spiritual level, I've gotten confirmed in the church just last Easter. Okay,
Since wonderful.
Since we've been separated. I'm a newbie. So I don't know what it does to me sacramentally. I don't know if it's staying on my soul that he's with another woman. And
no.
I don't know. No.
His sin, I'll tell you, his sin is his sin.
Okay. It's not a stain on my soul because we're married.
No. It's an injury to your marriage for sure. Now, of course, my advice would be that if it's at all possible that you two could reconcile, even though he's done this terrible thing, if it's in God's providence that the two of you can reconcile, that, of course, is the optimal goal. Now, the church provides in canon law that if you, as the injured party, you're the victim in this, that if your husband takes up with another woman, you can separate from him. You can live separately from him. You can, and you would be well within your rights, and I'm assuming you've already done this, you just say, no more marital intimacy. Yeah. That stops. So you have, the church recognizes that you as the victimized spouse, you have those kinds of rights, and sounds like it's already a done deal. But if he's hell-bent on going in that direction and he will not reconcile with you, and the only way for you to find out whether or not you can be free to marry, if that's something that you choose, would be to have to find out if the marriage was valid in the first place. That's where the annulment process comes in. You probably have heard all about that by now.
Even though I wasn't married sacramentally, we weren't married in the church when we were married, I would still have to get an annulment on top of the divorce?
Yes, for this reason, because let me put it this way. I think there are some scenarios where you can say it looks like a slam dunk that this was not a valid marriage because of X, Y, or Z, like you just said. But the church says, let's be sure. Let's just be really sure, because that's how seriously the church takes the validity of a marriage. And if it's a valid marriage, then neither he nor you are free to get remarried. So the church wants to do the due diligence. But in some situations where it's very clear on the face of it, usually, as I understand it, those annulment processes go through rather quickly. They can be expedited based upon the circumstances. But you would still need to do that just to make sure.
Yeah. I mean, he just doesn't want me to marry again. He doesn't want me to fall in love and get married again. It's like he wants to keep me captive, you know? And it's just weird. But it's like, hey, I'd like to move on with my life and have a sacramental marriage in the church because it sounds pretty beautiful to me. So, anyway, that was my question.
Well, he doesn't have that control over you. Check with a divorce lawyer and find out more specifically, or maybe do a little bit of Google searching. Another place I would refer you to, Lori, is an organization called Mary's Advocates. And if you write this down, their website is marysadvocates.org. And it was started by a woman who was abandoned by her husband. He just walked out on the marriage and victimized her in that way. And so she became, as a result of her own suffering, she became, you know, kind of an amateur expert on all the ins and outs that are involved with your situation. So get in touch with them, marysadvocates.org. I think you'll find they can give you some really helpful advice and guidance, okay?
All right, great. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. You're welcome, Lori. So sorry that this is going this way. We'll take a break and we'll come back. You're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, and I have a free book for you. It just came out. It's called Inquisition, my 26th book. And this one is different from all the others because it's a compilation of quizzes that I wrote for you that will test your knowledge of all kinds of things Catholic, saints and history and popes and the Bible and doctrines and customs and all kinds of things. And there's something here for you. You're going to enjoy it. I can tell you that. And it's free, which is even better. You don't pay for shipping or handling. And you need to get your copy ordered quickly because they're almost gone. And it only took about 2 weeks for them to be almost gone. So go to relevantradio.com/quiz and order your free copy of my brand new book at relevantradio.com/quiz. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. How about Rose in Pittsburgh? Good morning, Rose. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you. Not too bad for a sinner.
God bless all the work. God bless all the work you do. I have a question for you. I am in Pittsburgh, and there is a conference taking place this week and actually starting this evening called the Catholic Identity Conference. Are you familiar with it at all?
I am. I've seen it sort of promoted on social media here and there, so I'm aware of it. I haven't really done any deep research, but I'm aware of it. And it's going to be a public, an attempt at a public rebuke of Pope Francis and an assorted group of people, including Archbishop Vigano, will be attending, be part of this. And I have nothing to do with it, and I don't encourage anybody to participate because I don't think this is the proper way to handle what we perceive to be, or what those who do perceive to be, a problem. I don't think this is the right way to go about it. So I am aware of it, but it's not something I endorse or promote.
Okay, because the Catholic bishop here said a statement that they are not affiliated with it, that they don't encourage, they don't support it, they don't endorse the event. And it's just a little concerning because I live in the city and I was looking at the conference speakers, and I personally know one of the speakers. And I think it's okay to be critical. I think it's okay to have diversity of thought. I think if we feel maybe the Pope's going the wrong way, we pray about it. But I agree with you. I don't think this is the right path to take, because I looked up the press release about it, and it does say that they want to formally declare a resistance to Pope Francis, which I think is very alarming as a Catholic.
Yeah, as I say, this is not the right way. Yeah, this, in my view, this is not the right way to go about, you know, whatever the goal is here. This is not the right way to go about it. So,
yeah.
I'm not sure what more to say.
I agree, and I just thought maybe we could pray about it. I mean, I just, you know, the devil wants to divide all the time. And sometimes things are so black and white, and we don't see it, and we get caught up in our anger, and we get caught up in, well, this is the way it was, and all sorts of patterns of thought. And it's just, it's a little alarming for me, and I pray for them. I mean, maybe on a personal level, people can find some good if they do attend this conference. I wouldn't go to it personally, and I would just want to pray for the speakers and the people attending that, you know, that they don't fall away and become heretics of the church, essentially.
Well, yeah, we don't want anyone to fall away. We're living in interesting times that are fraught with a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty and confusion and error, no doubt about that. And I am sympathetic to anybody who's concerned about that. I empathize with those who are anguished about some of the strange things that are going on in the church right now. But this is not a solution to that problem, in my view. So that's about all I can say. I'm not sure what else to say, Rose, but do pray for everybody concerned. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Arzace. I hope I'm saying it right, in Medina, Ohio. Good morning, Arzace.
Oh, hi, Patrick. I asked, it's Arzace, but it's okay. My name is hard. Anyway.
Arzace, okay.
Yes. So basically, I'll go straight to my question. So I follow a lot of pro-life profiles, you know, on Instagram, Facebook. So, and they're pretty reputable profiles. So whenever they post, you know, something about the current news or events going on, I repost most of them. So last night I reposted one. It's about the California bill that was recently signed or signed by Governor Mary Newsom into law yesterday. Mm-hmm. So it's the AB 2223. I'm sure you're more familiar than that than I have, but I am. I just briefly read through it. But anyway, so I reposted
this. Is this the one that's protecting abortion by codifying it into California law? I think that's the one you're referring to, right?
Yes, yes, that's the one. Right. Okay. So basically this post that I reposted mm-hmm. that I got a reaction from a friend who's more of a pro-choice, you know. So anyway, the post is from Anna Lulius. She's a pro-life person or a blogger.
But let me ask you this, just in the interest of time, that kind of detail is not necessary. Can you just let me know what the question is?
So my friend, she said that this is not entirely accurate based on the bill's wording, because the post was, it says California just allowed people to kill their babies born alive after failed abortion. So I just want to respond correctly to her. I don't know how to respond to her.
Well, I think the best way to respond would be to find out exactly what the verbiage is in the bill. You can look that up online. And then if her reference to it is accurate, then it's accurate. Uh-huh. If it's inaccurate and you want to clarify for her or for somebody else, well, this is mm-hmm. what the bill actually says. You could do that.
Yes, I actually briefly read through the bill last night. In defense to her, I didn't really read the bill before I even posted that or reposted it. So, but I briefly read through it, and it actually doesn't say exactly those wordings that, you know, that California would allow babies from failed abortion to just die. But I think it's more of an assertion from that bill.
Right. So that's what I would say, is you can clarify and just say, well, technically it says this, and I wouldn't stress out over this. I mean, after all, this is just Instagram. This is just social media. And you don't need to die on that hill. If you can be helpful, great. If you can spread a little bit of light and knowledge and information, that's great too. But I would not waste any time or energy stressing out about this or worrying about it. You know, do the best you can and just keep everything in perspective. This is just Instagram. Thanks, Arzis. It sounds like you're doing a wonderful job trying to shine a light in a dark place. Thank you. Let us now go to, I have an email I want to read here very quickly. And where did it go? It was right here. This requires a bit of clarification, because I think this listener, Manuel, misheard what I said. So Manuel writing into me from California. Hi, Patrick. You said earlier in the show that a Catholic getting married at a Protestant church is not a valid marriage. However, I have heard you say that if a Catholic gets married at the court, it makes it a valid marriage. Can you explain the difference? Thank you. Well, I didn't really say that. So I think there may be something got lost in translation. So a Catholic getting married at a Protestant church, under most circumstances, that's true, that would be an invalid marriage unless the bishop had given permission. And if the bishop gives a dispensation, as bishops sometimes do, if they're asked for one, then there could be a situation in which a marriage at a Protestant church under certain circumstances could still be a valid marriage. But as a general rule, no, it would not be if it was a marriage that wasn't consistent with the church's canonical form for marriage. However, I guess you got it exactly backwards. If a Catholic gets married at, let's say, the Justice of the Peace, and again, there's no dispensation from the bishop, and that would be a very unique situation. But if a Catholic just gets married at the Justice of the Peace and flouts the church's law about getting married according to canonical form, that would definitely be an invalid marriage. So I think you must have misheard me, and I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to clarify that, unless I misspoke. I don't think I did. I've talked about this sin so many times, or this topic anyway. Let's go now to Bob in Vero Beach, California. Hi, Bob. Hello, Bob. You are on the air, sir.
All right. You got a bad feeling about this, sir?
Okay, go ahead, Bob.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? All right.
Yes.
All right, I'm visiting my father-in-law down at Vero Beach, and he had a good question. He has a very strong prayer life. So he was asking, many times do you need to pray for a specific intention or for a person in alive or in purgatory? So I thought you'd have a great answer for that.
There's no limit. There's no limits. 1 Thessalonians 5:17 says, pray without ceasing. Pray without ceasing. So if your prayer is for the rest of your life, praying for a deceased loved one, for example, that's great. There's no upper limit. It's not as though God says, if you say this number of prayers, then you can move on to something else. It's just how you feel moved to pray for people, but pray all day, every day. Make your life suffused with prayer as best you can. I mean, we all have things to do, and you're not going to necessarily be consciously praying it every moment. But throughout the day, your formal prayers, your rote prayers, prayers that are extemporaneous from your heart, there's no upper limit. You could pray, and I think should pray, as often as possible for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, that
kind of liberating, isn't it?
I'm his father.
This is Joe.
Joe. And the only thing I have a daughter-in-law who's very ill about her throat. She has a serious medical problem. Do I continue to say the rosary? She looks like she's getting better. Do I continue to say it time and time again until she...
Yeah. Yeah, I would. I would just keep doing it. Or pray a different prayer. The rosary, of course, is a very powerful prayer. And there's no upper limit, I guess is what I'm saying. And you don't have to feel as though you've got to do a certain number. You just pray as you are moved to do so. Thank you. How about Tina in Cincinnati? Hi, Tina.
Hi, Patrick. How are you? Okay. My question one of my readings asked that I want to know how to pray for knowledge of God's will for me.
All right. And I'm not being flippant here, Tina. I'm really not. This is an honest answer to your question. Lord, please show me your will for my life. Please show me. Please give me a sign. Please help me to discern your will. I know that you want me to do your will, and I'm seeking to do your will, so please show it to me. And what did Jesus say? Think about this, Tina. He said, ask and it shall be given to you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Ask is the acronym there, or the acrostic, rather. So if you just take that little word, ask, ask, seek, and knock, and just apply that to this intention, Lord, I'm asking you. You told me to ask you, and I'm asking you. You told me to seek, and I'm seeking your will on this. You told me to knock at the door, and it will be open to me. So I'm asking you, Lord, in all humility and faith, that you would do that. And just keep praying that prayer. It's really as simple as that. There's nothing complicated about it, you know.
That's good. I like that, the simple answer. Okay, thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, Tina. Good to talk to you, and say a little prayer for me when you're making those prayers. Let's go to Mary now in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. I was wondering, what should a person do if they've had a supernatural experience or a vision, kind of? I used to think it was a disservice to God to talk about them with others, but lately I've read that it's kind of a disservice or denying God by not spreading the goodness of them. So, I'm just normal. I don't know why
do you feel that,
I've had them, but...
Do you feel that you have... Mary, did you feel that you received some kind of a vision or something?
Well, it was an experience I had. I had a couple. But, I can't imagine I'm the only one that has them, and you never hear about them. So I just wondered if there's like a book I could read to discern what they might mean or the validity of them or what to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, St. Ignatius of Loyola, rather, wrote a great deal about the discernment of spirits. And what he means by that is how to recognize, number one, the activity of God in your life, perhaps through angels or through holy intuitions and thoughts. Sometimes it could take the form of a vision or some kind of supernatural event. Not often, but it can happen. He also talks about the possibility of demonic influence, and how sometimes there are those who they think that they're experiencing, at least at first anyway, they think they're experiencing something that's heavenly, but it turns out to be a counterfeit, turns out to be something that the evil one is trying to do. And another good book, in addition to what St. Ignatius of Loyola has written about that, I would recommend a book by Father Cliff Ermatinger, E-R-M-A-T-I-N-G-E-R, Father Cliff Ermatinger, and it's called The Devil's Role in the Spiritual Life. And he's looking at this through the lens of the teachings of St. John of the Cross, who was a famous mystic. He was a contemporary of St. Teresa of Avila. So that book I have found very helpful and insightful. It's called The Devil's Role in the Spiritual Life. And then the third possibility is it could just be your own imagination. And some people have very vivid imaginations such that they think that something supernatural has happened, but it really isn't. It's just something from their own mind. And that's another possibility. And there's no shame in that. Sometimes people have thought this is God or an angel, and it's not. It's just their own imagination. So my advice would be for you, if this is something that you feel is pressing you, that you need to share it, the way to do that is to find a priest. I recommend a priest, not a lay person, and get some spiritual direction and ask him if he would give you some spiritual direction. It could lead to something more long-term, or it could just be a one-time conversation with him, and then lay it all out and just say, these are the things that happened, and I'm really not sure what to make of it. What is your advice? And if he is a wise spiritual director, he'll give you wise advice. So in the short time that I have left, I'll have to leave it at that. But don't let it trouble you. Don't let it nag at you. But if you feel impelled to share it, begin there. And if it's something that God indeed wants this shared at a wider level, then those doors will open. But take that first step, and that's what I would recommend. Thank you. Well, one more time, we're just about out of books. They're rapidly depleting. My brand new book called Inquisition. You can have your free copy by going to relevantradio.com/quiz. Until tomorrow, God bless you.